You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weinert, Kent, the editor-in-chief of American Theater. I'm here with
Deep Tran, associate editor.
And Susie Evans, I'm the senior editor.
And we have an all-American history podcast today, or at least that's a theme that seems to have emerged. We'll first talk about the new PBS documentary coming out this week, Hamilton's America. It'll be airing at your local PBS station. We'll also talk a little bit about Taylor Mack's musical history of the U.S. And popular music, told through popular music over one 24-hour period. And then we'll have an interview with Lynn Nottage, whose play Sweat was actually commissioned as part of Oregon Shakespeare Festival's American Revolutions sort of history-based commissioning project, and is now going to be at the Public Theater and could not be more relevant to, in many ways, to this election cycle. Maybe not the last turn in it, but in a lot of the themes that have come up in this election cycle. So let's start with Hamilton's America. We've all seen a screener. What did we think of this documentary? It's 90 minutes, and it tells the story of the show's creation.
And also with background detail about Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton's right. life, and also a little bit about George Washington, just about all the figures that show up in Hamilton.
Right. I mean, I think it tells the backstory of the show's creation and the history behind it in a sort of interesting, deft way where it goes through the show itself. It kind of goes from the opening number to the closing, and each along the path it tells stories as we get introduced. It's kind of deftly done. So you get a picture of the shape of the whole show, and then as we stop along the way, there's a bit Eliza and the women, there's Jefferson, there's Washington, and it touches on all those things. And of course, the backdrop of
the duel.
The duel, yeah, right, exactly.
But as it goes through the show, it also goes through the shows like gestation, like Jeffrey Seller, the Broadway producer, doesn't actually come in until they get to the point where it might transfer to Broadway. He's right. Not actually a source. I don't know, I thought it was really well told and well shot and well done. As someone who's been immersed in the Hamilton world for the past 2.5 years, I knew almost everything that they said.
Same.
But I know that I'm a very rare case, so it's funny because I remember seeing that PBS crew at like every Hamilton event. I half expected to like be in the background in like half of those shots. I was like, oh, I was there. So I thought it was really well told. I didn't know how much new information I had for people who were Hamilton crazies.
Yeah, well, you know, there was just no new information if you've been a devotee. Evaluated as the thing that struck me the most, I thought, is that we've been so immersed in Hamilton itself and the world of Hamilton, the language, the look, the world they've created, which is sort of has its own logic, and it's going to be hard to think about American history without that overlay. But then to place what was most striking is in the documentary, the visually placing these people we almost know as well or better than the historical figures now, David and, you know, Chris and all those folks, to place them in the settings and doing that. I think that was actually a fairly profound, just to put those two up against each other. It was sort of informational and fun. And then also haunting the whole thing, as Chris finally makes clear, is when he goes to Washington slave quarters. I think
that was amazing. Chris was a big featured player in this documentary.
Yeah. Well, no, I thought that was good because I gotta say, you know, the hagiography of Lin-Manuel Miranda, richly deserved. But, you know, I noticed the first credits on this documentary were executive produced by Jeffrey Seller and Lin-Manuel Miranda. I mean, this was not going to be a piece that looked into any of the challenges that went into the compensation package mm-hmm. that came out for the performers. It wasn't going to go into that kind of trade stuff about the show, which I think is fine.
Yeah.
I think as a documentary for people to be introduced to Hamilton, they've heard about it. They maybe even have the soundtrack. This is as good as it could possibly be.
Oh yeah. You could learn a lot about the show from this. Totally.
I feel like it tried to be both a documentary about a musical, but also a documentary about a person, Hamilton, and right. that period in the war. But it didn't really go deep into either of those things. Like, it was all very, it only talked about the history in relation to what is portrayed in the show. It really doesn't go deep into such as they make one remark about you know, Washington owning slaves, but really not into like how many of the other founding fathers owned slaves.
They mentioned Jefferson.
They talk about Jefferson. I think, again, they, it is, yes, it's just a documentary just about this musical and what's behind it. It's not about.
But I didn't feel like it went really deep into, you know, the concerns of writing a musical, how difficult it is. Yeah. It just seemed like, oh, Lin-Manuel Miranda had this idea, and then a year later, boom, it's a musical.
Well, I did like that they started filming it so early. Like, they had footage before Lin knew what it was going to be, like in his empty apartment. They had footage of him writing in Burr's bedroom.
And then the sort of summit meetings he has with Tommy.
Yeah,
and,
I loved the footage like of the cabinet meeting. Yeah.
They hit a lot of those points. It's true that we didn't really see the guts of the process of like getting this up and like put like
we weren't
there's
in the
no rehearsal
room.
There's no rehearsal room exactly. shot. There's nothing
or
about
like
that.
Casting
it's true.
Casting or like really That's get true. Into why they yeah. did it the way they did it. I feel like if it was for people who didn't know anything about the musical, they didn't really address why they cast it the way that they did.
Yeah. It wasn't like the Chorus Line documentary where that was all about casting and rehearsals.
Right. So it wasn't a trade. It wasn't a theater trade documentary, like a backstager. It had some of those elements. I agree. Mm. It was, I mean, if there's any sort of not deficiency, but something that the film couldn't really take on, but is right there. Having like Timothy Geithner and Hank Paulson and Paul Ryan and like current
George W. Bush,
Laura Bush,
and Obama. It's like to have politicians. We've gone through. We went through this huge financial crisis, you might remember, and like Wall Street was probably just have what's her name, Maria Bartiromo, just walking around Wall Street because here it is. Like,
it's like, it's so amazing, Wall Street, and nothing about like how the role that it plays within our political system.
Yeah, I think that backdrop was kind of like conspicuously present, but not really. That was where they, like, I think they addressed some of the concerns that are brought up by the story, like slavery and federalism and blah, blah, blah. But not the financial situation. Like, I feel like just, again, it's those sources are interesting. I'm sure they're all Hamilton nerds, right? Hank Paulson seems to know a lot about Hamilton, and that's great. Did that have something to do with how well or poorly he handled the financial crisis?
Well, I thought it was funny they referred to the debt plan that Hamilton gets when he trades the Capitol as, like, the first bailout. Yeah. I don't know. My favorite part was when Leslie Odom Jr. and Lin-Manuel Miranda went to, I don't forget which museum it was, and they read those letters back and forth before the duel.
Yeah, A. Dot Burr.
I had no idea they actually signed their letters, A. Dot mm-hmm. Ham and A. Dot Burr. Like, they were reading it, I am forever your obedient servant. I'm like, these are the lyrics of the show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think what's striking is Hamilton is a great work in part because it's immediately accessible and enjoyable, but it has so many layers in it that I mean, I discovered as I was reading the Turner biography, and then I went and saw it after I read some more, that we've talked about this before, The World Turns Upside Down, was the actual song.
I know.
Not that tune, but the British have some song I'd love to hear the tune of that they were singing. Maybe Taylor could sing it sometime. That they were singing when they lost or when they surrendered.
Oh, no.
And those kind of details, the quotes from Macbeth, the quotes, like, you know that Lin Manuel lifted as much as he possibly could from the record, like, and the fact that the letters back and forth did sort of sound just like the lyrics, it wasn't surprising. It's just like, there's like all these layers.
That's what I'm talking about, not going deep enough, because they don't go really deep into the history, but they don't really go deep into creation. So they don't, there's this wonderful conversation they have with Stephen Sondheim and John Goodman about how you write a history musical. And I would have loved more about, you know, about like what do you pick and what do you leave out and what did Lin-Manuel leave out, and also like his musical influences. Like if it's going to be a musical, I mean, a documentary about the creation of a musical, just embrace the fact that it's a documentary about the creation of a musical and really get into the nitty gritty. Okay, this is what inspired me. This is what I lifted things from, and this is also like my hip hop, you know, idols that I also borrowed from.
Interviewed Nas. I mean, I thought that was a super limited.
Yeah. I mean, I loved what Sondheim said, or was it, oh my gosh, what's his name? John Weidman?
Well, yeah, John Weidman.
John said about, like, write the parts that you think are the musical.
A musical, right.
I could have watched, like, a whole documentary of just the three of them talking.
No, I think what we're saying is we wanted more of every element. Like, we could have gone down wormholes of each of these. Like, even just having the women play the Skylar sisters at the house. I mean, I could watch a reality show about them going around.
The funny thing about that, and even like that scene, and when Lynn and his dad are...
That's been covered before too, them going to the house.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, Lynn and his dad talking on the bench, that was a Playbill article. They're wearing the same thing. So Playbill was there that same day. Them at that house, that's a New York Times article. They're in the same outfits in the photo. I'm like, wow, there were like four press people at every single one of these things.
I mean,
marketed the shit out of that show.
Well, I think to answer who's the audience, it's people like my dad who just read the Chernow biography and has heard about Hamilton and probably is not going to be able to, he lives near Chicago, so maybe he could get tickets one day. But he may never get it. He's really interested in it. He wants to know more about it. This would be the perfect show for a lot of people in America who've heard of Hamilton. They might have heard the soundtrack, but they might not be the kind of people who would put it on and listen
soundtrack,
to it much.
Soundtrack, Rob. Original cast recording.
Whatever. the record. The record. You know, and so this is, and also I think students, people who, I think that the show and this documentary does a great service in terms of just saying more and giving context.
Yeah, it's not digging deep on any level, but it touches on a lot of things.
I guess if you haven't been reading a lot of the Hamilton coverage, then this would be new and informational.
I don't know. It's like, you know, like I'm a sort of a huge Beatles fan, and like I'll see anything, and I know all that stuff. I know it already, but I'll just watch it again.
Oh, yeah.
'Cause it's like I want to spend time in the company of their work and that material.
Fully entertained by it, even though I knew most of it. I thought that one of the more moving parts was also when they sang at the White House and Chris Jackson sang Teach Him How to Say Goodbye, and they like close up on Obama.
Yeah,
his last term.
Well,
that was amazing.
I would love to watch that whole performance. Is that available?
Yeah, there's only three videos available from that performance.
And it's not that one?
I mean, it's for all the obvious reasons that blew me away. And just the sort of underlying thread of the way this musical was like the musical of the Obama era.
It is, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it literally is it
started at the beginning
at the White House, essentially.
It started at the beginning of his term in 2009.
Right, right. Exactly. And I just find that really moving. I just
more about that. And they interviewed each other too, so.
Yeah. I mean, that was a pretty light interview, but I mean, yeah. Obama had some great quotes.
I thought, I mean, there might have been political reasons this didn't happen, but I thought Hillary Clinton has had so many fundraisers with Hamilton. She didn't appear in the documentary anywhere.
No, she didn't.
She's a little busy right now.
She didn't need to be interviewed, but they could have used footage from the.
My two laugh out loud quotes were when Obama said, when I heard you can do a rap at Alison Hammond, I thought, good luck. And then when David said, they wrote some amazing things and they also sucked about some of the founding fathers.
They're humans, which is a really great point that they drove home about Hamilton the musical, which is showing these, you know, mythical figures and all of their flaws and all of their glory as well.
Right.
Because you're not really taught that, and that's why it's really grabbed a lot of young people. But my favorite quote actually was from George W. Bush. I wrote it down, and he says, the reason that, you know, Hamilton's not really remembered in relation to the other founding fathers, he said, that's the way history works. Sometimes it takes a while for people to give you credit.
I mean, come on. That was such a self-serving and crazy quote.
That was great. I love how they had that big section about how, like, they were terrible guys and also did some great things. And then that ends with like George W. Bush being like, they were such amazing guys.
Yeah, that's a subtle subtweet there. Yeah. It was startling to see Paul Ryan, civic student Paul Ryan going, I really researched the Federalist Papers. It's really important to, like,
I thought he did a good job.
He's fine. It's just like he's so much in the news right now. It's like Paul Ryan. Oh my God, it's Paul Ryan.
Or him talking about, you know, Alexander Hamilton stands out because he was the one founding father who was an immigrant who came from nothing and then made his fortunes here. And I'm just like, you don't like immigrants, Paul.
Also,
Ryan.
Well, I mean, whatever. I think we don't have to adjudicate that. I will say what's fascinating is that Hamilton choice, it's been talked about, where he went with Jefferson over Burr because Jefferson was someone of principle. That is the choice people are asking Republicans to make right now. Like, not to compare Burr to Trump, but it's like, which person which candidate has principles and which one, even though you could not find two people who disagreed more than Jefferson and Hamilton.
That's really interesting. I didn't think about it that way.
Oh yeah. No, it's been brought up over this whole crazy election year that like, why don't, I think someone wrote an op-ed to this effect, like, conservative.
Clinton has beliefs. Trump has none.
Yeah,
it's exactly. One syllable.
Oh yeah, no, someone should do that rap.
Yeah,
I think also you're never gonna be president now. Is a very relevant.
Well,
rap.
And
Lynn did it on SNL.
Exactly. Yeah. No. Yes, of course.
It's worth watching.
Informative. It's definitely informative.
Informative. We recommend it. It's on your local PBS. Someone young.
Yeah, airing on October 21st.
Which is
Friday, the day after Friday. We release this podcast.
Great. Moving on to our next topic, after a word from our sponsor, Read American Theater. All right. that's an entire ad for our sponsor. Let's see. In fact, joking aside, Susie will have a post up about her experience in watching this 24-hour show. So it was Taylor Mack's 24-Decade History of Popular Music. Is that the right title?
Yes. 24-Decade History of Popular Music. Mack has been performing it and workshopping it for 5 years. He's definitely been working on it longer than that, but I think the first time he performed it was 5 years ago. The conceit is that every hour is a different decade from 1776 to 2016.
Mm-hmm.
He's been performing it all over. He did it at New York City Film this summer, workshopping it, and he's been doing it at St. Anne's. He does it in 3-decade spurts, which he calls acts. There's 8 acts. And for one time only, I mean, the whole piece is conceived to be performed in a 24-hour period, but obviously you can't do that several times. So it was all conceived to do that. So last weekend, about 600 to 800 people fled into St. Anne's. And he performed the entire thing from 1776 to 2016, and it was one of the greatest experiences of my life, hands down.
From 12 p.m. to 12 p.m.
From 12 p.m. to 12 p.m. I'm not going to lie, fell asleep a few times, but I added it up, only slept for 2.5 hours, and only missed 1 decade, so it's going to sound like in my piece I was asleep for a while, but I was not. There was just a lot.
I fell asleep and missed a decade. It's a
yeah, I missed him singing Soliloquy from Carousel, and I'm so mad.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I saw it last year when Taylor did it at New York Live Arts, the 1900s, and it's so amazing because Taylor talked a lot about how he would never be casted as Billy Bigelow, even though he really wants to be.
Right.
And didn't that song traumatize him when he?
Yeah, he told the audience this song. I'm going to use that for it. The song used to fuck with me when I was little, and I realized the only song to make it stop fuck with me is to fuck with it. So he like sang it.
Wow.
Yeah. And Taylor's a genderqueer artist.
Yeah. And so
goes by Judy as the preferred pronoun, which we all fuck up. But it's interesting watching that song sung by a very typical masculine man, usually sung, and in the show's case, sung by Taylor in sparkly dress with the giant headdress, and it's a great way to like fuck with gender and like fuck with.
Yeah, I mean the whole show kind of plays the idea of gender. It's a very, I mean he's definitely looking at history through a very queer lens. He focuses a lot on the Stonewall riots in 1 decade. He focuses on the AIDS crisis. He focuses on, you know, the effeminate nature of Americans being mocked by British and like Yankee Doodle Dandy, like right off the bat. The other concept for the show is he has a new costume for every hour.
Designed by Machine Dazzle.
Machine Dazzle's amazing. He does the costume changes on stage. There's no intermissions, no breaks. I mean, there's little like musical interludes where Taylor can like go to the bathroom, but that's about it. There were actually a few times when Taylor's like, I need to go to the bathroom and I don't have a break here. And so Matt Ray, his music director, be like, I'll just play a song.
Just
so he just like played a song and vamped.
Yeah.
I mean, and they also, other conceits, there's 24 musicians on stage, including backup singers in the first act. And by the end, it's just Taylor playing at a piano.
And ukulele, right?
And a ukulele, yeah.
It just goes down to,
it's not the same musicians all the way through. They kind of tag team it a little bit.
Right.
And there was 1 decade, I think it was my favorite act, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where he brought these 2 singers from Detroit, and I'm checking on their names. I don't remember their names, but they were amazing.
And they came in because they were fully rested.
They were fully rested. Like, they came in at 6 a.m. fully rested. And that was the decade, even though it was my favorite. Taylor was hurting the most during that act. There was literally a point in time during that act where he goes, oh my God, we still have 5 hours. And the whole audience just leapt their feet clapping. They're like, you can do it. You can do it. But they came in fresh and they sang, oh my gosh, they sang Funky Dollar Bill. They sang Set Me Free. They were amazing. And the Deep saw that act too, and they were there too.
I did. I've seen 15 hours worth of this show.
Which hours haven't you seen?
I haven't seen, I didn't see the early 1800s. I didn't see the later 1800s with the Mikado set on Mars.
Oh, yeah, the Mikado set on Mars.
And I didn't see the 1990 to 2016.
Okay.
So I've seen a good amount.
The Mikado set on Mars is a highlight. But it's a weird act to see as a 3 hour because that's the dinner act. And so I saw that as the 3 hour at New York Change of Film, and I was like, this is so much shorter than 3 hours because the dinner takes up so much time.
My question is, there's a lot of audience interaction, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was the form of that? Like,
oh, there's tons.
Tamarian segregation.
Pretty much every act has some form of audience interaction. So, right.
I've gone up on stage before.
You went up on stage. I didn't go up on stage. Oh, so during the draft in World War I, he had all the men in the audiences age 14 to 40 come up on stage and, like, pretend they're in a trench and, like, pass around a bottle of rum. When it was the Oklahoma land rush, he had a bunch of balloons and there were, like, plots of land mapped out on the floor of the whole theater, and there weren't enough balloons for the audience, so he had to run to try and get a balloon and go stake out a plot of land. During the Civil War, he divided us into the Confederacy and Union soldiers and gave everyone ping pong balls and divided us heads to throw it at them. And if, like, hit you in the arm, you couldn't use your arm.
And fight each other.
And fight each other, basically. An audience member played Yum Yum in the Mikado and had, like, a voice changing thing with, like, a voice changing microphone and, like, lines being fed to him, and he had his own costume by machine. There was a whole thing he called the dream sequence in the very early 1800s. One whole act was, like, this heteronormative, like, workshop for a backers audition for a Broadway show for an Oscar film of, like, a jukebox musical, the musical of the time. So he, like, put it on his head and, like, here's my heteronormative musical, Harry Jane. It's jukebox from the early 1800s. And one whole hour of that, he blindfolded the entire audience. And we, like, I fed someone grapes. I don't know who they were. I sat on someone's lap. Like, yeah. During the immigration, Eastern European immigration, like the Jewish tenements decade, he brought out mattresses and, like, 10 people were sitting on a mattress together. That's when I fell asleep.
I mean, you put on a mattress and you've been up for 12 hours.
I didn't even, like, resist it. I was like, I'm getting a nap in.
For me, there was one part where Taylor talked about Manifest Destiny and the settlers. And so he pulled a bunch of us on stage and we played the Donner Party. and Taylor made us, you know, eat, like, the various people in our groups, and I committed to the eating of the people.
See, he did that in the 24 hours, but he only had two people do it. He didn't bring everyone up on stage. I was bummed because I'd heard about that ticket. I was like, that'll be fun. No, it was just two people.
Yeah. And Susie, my question is, so the background, the reason Taylor made the show, he was inspired by the AIDS crisis. When he was younger, Taylor went to an AIDS walk and noticed, like, as this community degrading because all these beautiful young men were dying of AIDS. But at the same time, AIDS is also bringing the community together in solidarity with each other. And the reason Taylor made this show was to give a queer lens on American history, but also to bring the audience together and have the audience, like, degrade and fall apart and then also bring everyone back together after that, like a phoenix kind of metaphor.
Yeah.
So, Susie, did the metaphor work for you? Did you feel in solidarity with the people?
I did.
You?
I was surprised that no one left. And from what I heard, I don't have this confirmed, but someone told me they talked to an usher or something. There were no medical emergencies. The only thing people used, like, the medical tent for were ibuprofen. Everyone stayed. I definitely felt wrung out, but I was surprised how at, like, 5 a.m. I was, like, pretty awake. And then I, like, lasted the last 7 hours. I was like, oh, I'm pretty good. I mean, the metaphor that was the most poignant, and it's kind of this metaphor of the whole show, was also the metaphor of one decade. He did one decade about the temperance movement and alcohol, and it was a bunch of drinking songs, and he had a temperance choir, and there were a lot of ping pong balls, and we were asked to throw ping pong balls at the temperance choir. And he said he did this decade to kind of illustrate how he started performing downtown in the clubs, and he had these very, you know, downtown audiences who don't usually go to places like St. Anne's or the Public Theater, and now, you know, he performs at Lincoln Center, he performs at Joe's Pub, he performs at St. Anne's, and he has a little bit more of the subscriber audience that aren't necessarily in the downtown clubs, and both of those people now come to his shows now, and so he wanted to kind of merge those audiences, and he kind of said he used the temperance decade as a metaphor for that. And then something he repeated throughout the whole thing, well, there were two things he repeated throughout the things. I'll save one of them for my article. But the other thing he kept saying was, everything you're feeling is appropriate. And there's like his like motto for the whole show was, it's a performance art concert. So if you go to a regular concert and you're not entertained, the musician has failed you. But like if you go to a performance art concert, you can hate it, you can love it, you can like be miserable and tired because I made you sit on the floor for 8 hours. True story. But you paid for this, and no matter what I do, I succeed.
And then wasn't, because you and one of our coworkers at TCG were at the show too, and weren't you guys talking about how towards the end, like, Taylor was, like, visibly really tired.
Oh my gosh,
he wasn't going to make it, and then the audience propped Taylor up.
Yeah, that was like I was saying during that 80s or 70s decade when he was like, we still have 5 hours. And like everybody like screamed for him. Nobody like went up and held Taylor, but like he definitely, there was a point in the 80s where he was going on to the next song and his music director goes, Taylor, you forgot a song. And Taylor goes, ugh, I can't sing that song right now. He was like so tired. And he was like, the audience is going to have to do it for me. And it was Purple Rain. And everyone's like, you got to sing Purple Rain. And then he sang it. And then in the last decade when it was just him and a ukulele and a piano, in the middle, he's like, I've never been this hoarse before. I wonder why.
There was a great, I didn't read it all, but the New York Times story about how he prepared his voice. I mean,
he kept getting like water bottles and like little smoothies brought to him. So I feel like there was some sort of vitamins in those.
Right, right.
And it was amazing.
Let me ask you this question. Is this going to have a life anywhere else in the future? Or?
According to Taylor, who tweeted at me, they're going to Australia.
Okay,
to do so the if you full want to 24 see this hour, again,
yes.
You got to go to Australia.
I mean, there's tons of YouTube videos of like
it
certain
is the land
songs,
of Oz.
Songs. So you can probably see a lot of the songs. I saw a great, there's a video from his Joe's Pub performance where he sings After the Ball, which is amazing.
Right.
You know, you can find some stuff.
And I'm sure like Taylor will be touring it around because that's what Judy did during, before this world premiere, but so I think considering all the demand for it in New York, it'll probably have a life after. So,
but I don't know how many times
he's Google alert to Taylor Matt.
I don't know how many times he's going to do it.
Yeah,
as
how many
a 24
times
hour
he can
concert.
Physically do it himself. I mean, it's like,
I mean, it was
there
exhausting.
There could be a demand for it, but it's like, how
people
much
are going to
want to
see it, but he can't keep doing it.
Right. Yeah. It's like, and I've heard people compare it to Marina Abramovich's, yeah. You know, her and her thing at MoMA, and also Tilda Swinton sleeping in the glass.
Yeah, the artist is present there. It's not like he can have an understudy.
Exactly, but unlike those, like they weren't talking. Like Taylor was like performing.
He might do 12-hour stints again. He's done 12 hours, and I actually think, I mean, I loved the 24 hours, but seeing it 12 hours might. It will do the same thing, but you also get to sleep.
What about one about the future decades? No. All right.
I don't know. His original music was good. The last decade was all original music.
Right. Well, that's fascinating, and I wish I'd seen it. But I remember his Lily's Revenge, which was a five-hour immersive spectacle where you had to turn in your cell phone. I think it happened right after my first son was born. It's like, you know, durational theater and parenthood. It's like I would have to just basically take a little vacation.
I mean, are durational pieces of this type, like, are they effective in, like, really bringing people together and, like, really getting across the message that the artist is trying to send? Or is it just an exercise?
I mean, Taylor did have, on Monday, I didn't go to it, but there was a meetup in front of St. Anne's for everyone who'd come to, like, talk about what they experienced. I didn't go, and people I know didn't go, but I'm sure some people went and, like, had a discussion. I don't think, I mean, Taylor, yeah, he had a point that he wanted to like bring people together and have them experience this, but I think it's like all art. It's you get out of it what you get out of it.
I think duration, I haven't read Jonathan Kalb's book. There's a great length it's called. I think David Cote reviewed it for us about durational theater. Durational theater, I can think of very few examples of people who've gone to an 8-hour thing or one of these plays which has an intermission who did not get something more out of it. It seems like the time itself is part of the theme, is the message. You've lived through mm-hmm. something with characters. I mean, it's like watching an epic movie where we see someone age through the years. Like, by the end, we like feel like we know them. Like, and I think when we see the Kentucky Cycle or Angels in America, which are some of the ones. Gats is another one. Yeah.
Gats
was 9 hours.
I could think, and people talked about Lily's Revenge as creating a community. That was only 5 hours, you know.
I mean, 5 hours. We can all do that now.
I mean, I suppose, but I think durational theater is its own kind of, it does pierce through the usual theater going habits. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I don't usually actually like durational theater. It's not usually what I gravitate towards, but this was incredible. This is probably the longest durational piece that's ever been done, right? 24 hours?
I think
Mike Daisy did do a 24-hour monologue at the Time-Based Art Festival a couple years
ago. Were there intermissions? Did he sleep?
I mean, I don't know if he slept. I think there might have been a few breaks for potty breaks or whatever. Yeah.
And how long is Einstein on the beach? 12?
I think it's 12.
I don't think it's even 12. I think it's less than that.
Okay.
It's very durational, but I don't know. I don't know exactly how long. Yeah, no, I'm sure there's an Erik Satie piece, which I can't remember, Vexations, or I think it's called, which is instructed to be played like 1,000 times in repetition. And there have been people who stage it, and they do tag team pianists who will come in and play it. And that is apparently a very mesmerizing like experience. For people I've known who've sat through that.
Just
like,
the same song played over and over?
It's the same little piece. It's not even very very long, and it's just like says the repeat signs. It says like repeat.
That 1,000. Sounds like just like listening to your iPhone alarm go off and not turning it off.
I think it's more and the fact that it's being performed by living people for that long. Anyway, yeah.
None of them are singing in heels, though.
He took his heels off a lot.
Oh, okay.
And one time he got, like, in the 80s or maybe it was the 90s, he got, like, flat shoes. He's like, I haven't had non-hurting shoes in a while.
Well, we can't say it's coming to a theater near you unless you live in Australia.
But check out on YouTube. There's lots of
clips. There's lots on YouTube.
Check out Susie's article about
yes.
it.
So another, I will set up my interview with Lynn Nodded. She took some time out from tech at the Public Theater to talk to him about Sweat. It's a play she wrote, as I said before, commissioned by Oregon Shakes about American history. And she, there's a long interview I did with her last June about this. It was up last July online, actually. And, how she wrote it, why she wrote it. It was after Occupy Wall Street, around that time she was thinking about inequality and about what she calls the deindustrial revolution of the U.S., which she thinks is going to be one of the big historical things we'll be looking back on. We're looking on it right now. So she went to Reading, Pennsylvania and she talked to a lot of folks there. That's an area that has been really hit hard. Used to be a big steel area and also textiles. And, this is, her play is about, sort of a tight-knit community, over an 8-year period, 2000 around the time of the Bush-Gore election, and then 2008 around the time Obama's about to come in, and how decimated the town is just in those 8 years. It's a fascinating, complicated play. When we spoke about it last June, as we will hear in the interview, we had no idea that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump would be real players and why. And the play just seems to speak, very directly to the current moment. So this is an interview with Lynn, and then we'll come back after that and give her recommendations. Last time we spoke, it was last spring, I think, before it went to Oregon. You were about to leave for Oregon, and you talked about how you wanted this play to play off the election in a way. You were looking forward to having a political impact or reflection. But we had no idea then what was going to happen with this.
I know, we certainly didn't at that moment. And I think in the conversation we were just talking about how I wanted the play to land, and I really wanted it to be in conversation with what was happening during the time and what I felt I was experiencing when I was going into small cities like Reading, Pennsylvania, in which the people were feeling rather disaffected.
Yeah.
And I felt like that disaffection wasn't something that was part of the national conversation. Right. And certainly Bernie Sanders came on the scene and he sort of elevated the voices of the working class.
Right.
But I feel like right now we're at a point where the conversation has become so convoluted and we're focusing on sort of the personal foibles of the individual candidates, and the real substance, the real issues are getting lost in the wash.
I know that you said that the thing that surprised you about Reading and doing the work there was identifying with people you would have thought of on the other side, a guy who had a swastika tattoo, I think, right? That you
had seen before.
Yeah, well, I wasn't saying that I identified with the guy who had the swastika tattoo at all, just for clarification. But
sure.
And I think specifically what I said I was identifying with it was a group of steel workers.
Yes, yes.
Who had been at a factory for the majority of them I spoke to between 25 and 30 years, who had deeply invested in the American dream, had bought their homes, and were beginning to send their children to college, and then literally had the rug pulled out from under them and didn't understand what had happened to this contract that they had signed.
Yeah,
and so for the first time, I felt like they felt what it was like to be a person of color in America,
yeah.
In which no matter how hard you work, you continually come up against a wall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that their narrative sounded familiar.
It sounded really familiar to me,
you know,
because I, as a person of color, I've certainly experienced being locked out, because these were factory workers that had been locked out.
Right.
And I thought, in many ways, people of color have been locked out of opportunity for so long, so right. It was familiar.
Now, you've stayed in touch with the folks already. I know some are coming to the show.
Yeah.
Obviously, Bernie Sanders is one voice.
Yes.
That working class whites were drawn to. There's the other voice and the other movement. And I wonder, do you feel like were there already signs when you were there in Reading that this would be ripe Trump country, basically?
You know, I don't know that Reading is ripe Trump country. I know that there's pockets around Reading. Certainly a lot of the people that I spoke to still were very much in the Bernie Sanders camp. They were sort of union people. But that's not to say that in surrounding areas there were a lot of people who I imagine were drawn to Trump. And, you know, what I like in what's happening in this sort of Trump revolution is that for so long, white people saw white privilege as a superpower.
Yeah.
And suddenly there is a kryptonite, and that kryptonite is diversity.
Yeah.
And it really frightens them. And that's what we're seeing. Yes, and Trump represents, so he's the buffer against the kryptonite, which is all of us who are saying, we're here, we have a voice,
right.
We want to be included in
That's true. The larger conversation. One of the things that makes your play more complicated and I think great is that it's complicated in that it's not just about union guys being thrown out of work by NAFTA. There's a complicated racial element to it as well, because, I mean, I think your play makes it pretty clear that the union that these guys all were part of wasn't very welcoming
to people of color.
Right.
And I think what I was interested in when I went to Reading, which I found fascinating, that it was a city that was very divided across racial lines. It was incredibly stratified. It was that they had a real us versus them mentality.
Right.
You know, and you had white folks in one district, black folks in another district, and Latino in another district. And those communities really weren't in dialogue with each other at all. But the other thing that I found fascinating, that it was also a class war.
Yeah.
That was going on.
Right.
Where you had a working class that had begun to sort of move into the quote-unquote middle class. I wouldn't even say quote-unquote. It was a working middle class.
Right.
That was
right.
Very comfortable, that felt under siege by a working class that hadn't yet moved into the middle class, which by and large were Latino folks.
Right, okay, so you're saying like sort of a white professional middle class? Not just white.
I wouldn't say that we're professional. It's not professional in the ways that we think of white collar workers on Wall Street, but it's people who are comfortably middle class who are working in industrial jobs two generations.
So ones who are still holding on to that sort of middle class jobs,
who were solidly middle class. They'd been able, with their salaries, to take vacations and buy homes and send their children to college.
Right, right. I mean, I've heard some studies that said that folks who are supporting Trump are not necessarily the poorest. They're folks like this who are middle class, but they live around a lot of what they see as decay and joblessness, and I'm talking about, you know, white working class, they see the opioid problems, and that's what they identify with. They don't want to slip away, and they also see these encroaching people of color that they don't understand.
I think that a lot of the white population that's supporting Trump is seeing their foundation eroded and don't understand why. And rather than entering into a larger national conversation, they retreat from it. You know, they metaphorically build the wall.
I guess the nut to crack for the left has always been trying to see, get poor, you know, working class whites and working class people of color to see common interests, but that's not.
It's not, but I do think to a certain extent that that was the conversation that Bernie Sanders,
tried to book. Yeah.
That was certainly where he was. It's like, hey, folks, wait a minute, we're all sort of sailing in the same boat.
Yeah.
This is not about race. This is about class. This is about disenfranchisement. This is about the 1% that's controlling the majority of the wealth and the 99% that is sort of struggling to survive.
Right. Didn't ask about your play. Does the play feel different, sit differently with you since in this past year, this crazy election?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It certainly sits differently now that Trump
seems to be imploding.
Mm-hmm. I feel that it remains incredibly urgent because I still don't have a sense that this issues around poverty and economic stagnation are on the platform.
Right.
You know, what I feel is that there's a lot of discussion about foreign policy. There's a lot of discussion about their personal relationships.
But
what I don't hear is what is going to happen to the working class? How are we going to bring jobs back to America? How are we going to create opportunity? How are we going to tear down the prison industrial complex?
Right.
It's like, I want tangibles, and I don't hear the tangibles.
No.
And that, for me, is very frustrating.
Yeah, part of it, I think, is Hillary's a flawed candidate in that way, I think, in some ways, because her natural tendency might not be that. But also, I think she's running. The guy she's running against, she's had to focus on these other things, partly, right?
Which is really unfortunate. Yeah. I feel like she really hasn't been able to get into the meat and potatoes of who she is as a candidate because she's constantly deflecting. I mean, she's in a defensive mode, and that's really sort of the most dangerous place to be when you're a candidate.
Yeah.
She can't go on the offensive in the same way because she's playing with the biggest bully on the block. You know, and every time she runs up against him, you know, he finds a different way to knock her down.
Right, right. So do you, I think the cast of The Humans was joking about who would support which candidate, right, during the primaries and stuff. Do you think about in your play who's...
Well, I know in my play. I have a couple of characters who I doubt will even make it down to the...
Make it down.
To the polls. Right. I have, one or two who may lean toward Trump. I have some Bernie Sanders supporters. I have some Hillary supporters. I think in the play there's really a cross-section of the electorate represented.
I think it's still set in 2008. Is the end?
It's 2008. It's set in 2000 and 2008.
Right.
So it spans 8 years. It spans the 8 Bush years.
And I saw the play in Oregon, and it was great there. I think last time I saw you, you and Kate were fretting about the short preview time, but everything seemed to work out.
We've only had 3 days of previews, which is like unheard of. As coming from New York, it just is really frightening to have 3 days before you welcome the critics in to see.
I know, but luckily Charles Isherwood loved
it. I feel very blessed and thankful.
And then the arena production was a similar cast or some replacements, right? Yeah. But this is a new cast and
a new
production.
We have a few.
Oh, there's a few from Oregon.
A few from Oregon.
Great. Jack?
Jack isn't joining us.
That's right. Do you feel like the play has substantially changed since then, or is it still the same play?
I think fundamentally it's still the same play. It's been nipped and tucked a little bit.
Right, right.
But
right.
I feel like it is the play that it was.
It's the play that it was, yeah. I mean, I know when you wrote the play, it was for American history, or American Revolutions about history. And I was talking about how this is pretty recent history. But now we're, you know, a year and a half away. Does it feel even further away, or does it feel like more?
You know, it's funny because when I was writing the play, it felt very remote and very distant.
Yeah.
Now it feels like we're living it. That it doesn't feel like a history play. It feels very much like a contemporary play. And I think that when people see it, it's going to be received in that way.
Right. And there's lines that are going to play differently.
It's going to play very differently. And also because the play takes place on the eve of an election. So it's the year ramping up to the election in 2000. And
Right.
George Bush. And then it ends on the eve of the election in 2008. And so we are opening the week before the election in 2016.
Right. I think you told me that when you went to Reading, you were looking for stories of resurrection and hope.
Yes.
Do you feel like you didn't really get them?
You know, it's, I'm such an optimist, mm-hmm. and I always sort of move toward the light. And when I travel somewhere, I'm always looking for those little patches of sunshine.
Yeah, sure.
And in Reading, I did find these incredible patches of sunshine, sort of embodied by individuals.
Yeah.
Like this one guy named Dr. Will Davis, who had come back to Reading after serving some time, and he had gotten his PhD, and he had started a community gardens and a green market, and had brought together all of the people of color who run businesses.
Right, right.
And then, and he was someone who sort of guided us through the city for about a year and a half, and then he called me one day, and he's like, I hate to break it to you. I'm leaving. I'm like, Dr. Will Davis, you can't leave.
And he's
like, I have to leave. He's like, I met someone and I'm in love and
right,
I just
right.
don't feel I can raise a family in this town, even though this is where I was born and raised.
Yeah.
And so I think that I want to be hopeful for Reading.
Right.
But without a strong tax base,
mm-hmm.
without yeah. sort of intelligent leadership.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that it will be able to resurrect itself in the next 5 to 10 years.
So as a playwright, you had to be honest about that.
I have to be honest yeah. about it, and that's why I think the ending of the play is open-ended. I know that people like resolutions. They like for us as artists to come up with solutions, but I really feel like I don't know what the solution is. And,
yeah.
And I don't know what the conversation is going to be. So I left it open.
The last question was, I wanted to get back to your tech rehearsal. I'm sure that's a lot of fun. I don't know, you're like any baker, you like tech or not so much?
Yeah, I like tech. I love seeing all the little elements come together. It's fun.
It's just about, you talked about doing an art installation or something with Reading and mm-hmm. the Labyrinth. I don't know if that's still...
Yeah, we're still working on it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, we ran into some obstacles. There was a space that we're really attached to and that we're hoping to move into in last spring.
Right.
And we finally tracked down the guys who owned it, and it would cost like $150,000 just to get the electricity turned on and get the roof fixed. And we're like, we don't have that kind of money.
Decaying.
And then, another opportunity, which is an even better opportunity. It's the Reading Railroad Station.
Wow.
Was abandoned and then recently refurbished, and it's been sitting empty for like a year and a half. And it's centrally located. It's downtown. It has excellent parking. And the symbolism is really quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so we're hoping that we might be able in the spring to move into that space. But that space is in limbo because
okay.
it's between BARDA and the mayor's office. And
oh,
so
I see.
Someone just has to get the key to give to us.
So this is I think I went past over quickly. It was like an installation art project with the Labyrinth Theater Company and you
yeah.
doing some performative
I think that we had discussed this, I guess, some time ago that
yeah.
we were really interested in bringing something back to Reading.
Yeah, yeah.
And we didn't just want to bring a piece of art that sort of sat there, but want to bring something that's interactive and multimedia that's putting this very fractured community into conversation with each other.
Right. Right.
And so we've spent a lot of time sort of brainstorming and figuring out what that would look like, and I think we've come up with something that's quite wonderful.
Right. I feel like, not to follow on more, but you, yourself, and Kate, and the actors really embodied, even though you were miles away in Ashland, Oregon, were able to embody the world of Reading, I think, I mean, I haven't been there, so I don't know how faithfully, but I know that that's been a concern of you as a writer and as a, just to like give them voice. So the people from Reading are going to come see it.
Well, the people of Reading have come to see it.
They've seen the previews already.
In Oregon,
so they came to, yeah.
the former mayor of Reading came to see it and a couple of folks from Reading, and they said, you know, you kind of got it. And then in Arena, we had some of the steel workers who had interviewed who came to see it and who
oh,
were
great.
Incredibly moved by the piece and felt like I did capture
right, right.
what they were going through. And
well, that means a lot.
Yeah, and to me it meant the world.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you have a gift of not just capturing the individual experience, but something that we can all relate to. Thank you, Lynn, for taking the time. It's a crazy time right now.
You're welcome. It is a crazy time.
Everyone's thinking about the election all the time.
I know,
right?
It's all news. I wish we had better options.
Yeah, no, I know.
we're back. We have some recommendations of things we like that you might like or want to know about. Susie, why don't you start?
Sure. So I have been going to a lot more theater lately because I didn't see it much over the summer, so I've been catching up. And I saw Heisenberg at Manhattan Theater Club on Broadway last night, and I was very surprised by how much I enjoyed it. Also, it's on Broadway, I know, but it's also a two-hander with actors of a certain age, so it will be coming to every regional theater in America after its Broadway run.
Good point.
What's it about?
It's, okay, it stars Mary Louise Parker and Dennis Arndt, and they are in England. He's Irish, and she's American, and they, like, meet on this train platform, and she's like kind of like she's a little bit kooky, and she likes to like lie, make up lies about herself, and she's like, he reminds her of someone, so she's like very obsessive about him, and he's like a lot older, and he's like very kind of annoyed by this woman, and they exchange enough information, and they're like bye, and then she Googles him and finds him, and he's like, what are you doing? And then they may or may not like fall in love, or maybe she's manipulating him, who knows. It's just kind of a cool little two-hander. It's by Simon Stevens, a playwright who's very good. I don't always like his work, but I really enjoyed this one. So I guarantee you it will be at every single regional theater.
Why is it called Heisenberg?
No idea.
The uncertainty principle, right?
Maybe. That makes sense. Yeah.
When I heard that, it was just a play about Heisenberg. Like, Copenhagen was about Niels Bohr, but it's not. It's not.
Well, there is a lot of uncertainty. You never know if the other person's like being truthful to the other person. So
maybe that's. I think that's maybe the reference.
I just think of Breaking Bad when I...
That's right. Well, that was a reference to that, right?
Yeah. Well, it's good. It's 85 minutes, so it's a nice little... We'll start at 7 p.m. I was at home at 8:30.
Yeah, it's going to be on the most produced playlist for sure.
Yeah, it's great.
And Ms. Tran, you just got back from Oregon Shakespeare Festival and the Kata. I don't know if your recommendation has to do with that. I just thought I would mention that.
Yes. Only two of the shows I saw will have a life beyond what I saw at OSF. One is Viet Gone, which I've already recommended on this podcast. You can check out my New York Times article about that, Viet Gone by Quy Nguyen. And the other show I'm recommending is Row by Lisa Loomer, which it's playing at Oregon Shakespeare Festival until the 29th of October, and then it will be at Arena Stage in D.C. January 12th to February 19th. And it's about the two women on the Roe versus Wade case. It's about the plaintiff, Norma McCorvey, who was a Roe in Roe v. Wade, and also the woman who defended her, Sarah Weddington. And it's about like their diverging paths post the case and how Sarah became like a first generation feminist and Norma McCorvey became a pro-lifer. So it doesn't make a case for either or in terms of anti-choice or pro-choice, but it's about like, I feel like it's a show about the institution of feminism and how like it tends to leave out women whose views don't line up completely with what the doctrines are talking about.
Right. Okay. I think Lisa told me that she wanted to write a play that would send both sides. We're not screaming out of the room, but just both, that would make both sides both represented and also upset. Do you feel like you were angry as well as, you know, represented?
I mean, I was angry in so far as I always just hate seeing anti-choices, you know, their rationalizations for acting the way that they do. And I'm one of those people that I'm very firm in my beliefs. And so, I'm not going to waver on the anti-choice or pro-choice side. Like, I am incredibly pro-choice, and most of the people in that audience were.
Right.
OSF. You know, we're all liberal theater people, and sure. when there's a pastor saying abortion is murder, and it's okay to bomb abortion clinics, you're going to boo that. There's just no way around it.
Right.
And but so I don't think it's like an even portrayal of both sides. I think it's a portrayal of how people become pro-lifers and also like just the gnarly questions about abortion and how legally it's tough to legislate it because the courts and the government can't even decide and the doctors can't even decide what is life? And so they've set life legally at 24 weeks,
right, right, right.
which is, for all intents and measures, an arbitrary thing, especially if you talk to the anti-choice people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know the play, but I wonder if it's the Roe decision that also carves out rights in the, you know, that aren't necessarily spelled out in the Constitution, and there's folks who are worried about its legal constitutional basis and whether it's firm, you know, because it's under privacy, right?
It's under privacy, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. I hope that there seems to be an OSF arena like pipeline, right?
I think
sweat went from there. I hope it.
Well, Arena prides itself on doing "quote unquote" political theater, and exactly. OSF right. has the American Revolutions commissioning program.
Makes perfect sense.
And Molly Smith loves her political plays, especially when they have a feminist edge to them. So, I really recommend it. Though it's not in just to explore like a side of history that I was never taught.
Right.
Because I didn't know Norma the Roe became a pro-lifer.
Yeah. No, not a lot of people do. And it was fairly recent. I mean, it was in the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was after that.
Roe versus Wade was in 1990.
No, when she became a pro-lifer.
Oh, okay.
So there was that TV movie with Holly Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was before Norma McCorvey.
Yeah, it was.
Became pro-life, right?
Yes.
I don't remember. Yeah, that's how long ago I saw that. So briefly, I don't want to cut you off. Is that your recommendations? That's it? Or there's more?
And I also have an article that you should read. It's in the New York Times. It's called The Unimaginable by Michael Paulson.
Yeah.
And then it's about Oscar Eustis and how he's recovering from the death of his son who committed suicide 2 years ago. And also about his future vision for the public theater.
It's interesting. Adam Green had a piece like that.
Adam Green wrote it too.
5-6 months ago, which was a great piece. But this one looks, I haven't read it all the way through. It looks great.
They used our formatting. They had like the bold first line thing. I was like, this is how we format our articles.
I will say, I tweeted this out. I think I may have mentioned this before in the podcast. I was aware of this, of the news about Oscar. It wasn't widely public. When I went to Hamilton preview, he sat in front of me. And when they got to the scene about the son dying.
It's Quiet Uptown?
Yeah, or The Unimaginable, just when he's actually.
Yeah, it's Quiet Uptown.
The song's not called The Unimaginable?
No, it's called The Quiet Uptown.
I haven't looked at the soundtrack lately.
the cast album!
No, but he was, you know, I could tell he was shaken. And he's talked about, I think, the Adam Green piece and maybe the Michael Paulson piece too, about how going through that every night, he would go through that dark place and then come out transcendent. That's why he was in the audience every night.
Yeah, Adam Green's piece and Michael Paulson's piece, they both had the anecdote about how Lynn sent him the MP3 of that song before anyone had heard it in rehearsal, and he and his wife only listened to it for like months, that song.
Yeah. Anyway, so to totally change the subject, my recommendation is Cirque du Soleil's new show, Curios. It's at the Randall's Island. I was probably going to tour. I will say Cirque du Soleil doesn't really need a lot more press, but I've been seeing their work on and off for 30 years. I think I saw them when they first came to the U.S. in Santa Monica, the tent out there, like 87, 88. And I was mesmerized by the first couple of shows I saw, and then a couple others later. But I will say, I don't know if anyone's had this experience. They see Cirque du Soleil, it's amazing. You see a couple more shows, like, it's kind of seen it, right? I mean, I think because I've been away for a while, I also think it just was just beautiful and a great show. And
didn't you take your son to it too?
And I probably had something to do with the fact I have been away for a while, so it was like fresh again. And also I took my 7-year-old and he was mesmerized, not just by the feats of acrobatics and all, but all the extra stuff they do to aestheticize and sort of give it this strange narrative, quasi-narrative world with characters. He just ate that up, just like these phonograph records.
He sits still the whole time?
Yeah, no, he's 7. You can totally,
really?
I mean, you're totally mesmerized. Yeah. This one, I think, just
babysitting.
This one, I think, works especially well.
I can't memorize them. I'm not seriously.
7-year-olds aside, I think it works especially well with. There's something about they've set it in sort of a 19th-century Jules Verne. Yes, steampunk, I guess, is one way to put it. Sort of like Cabinets of Curiosity, and that aesthetic seems to mesh really well with their sort of with their French Canadian retro. It's beautiful. I highly recommend it. If you haven't seen Cirque du Soleil in a while, this might be the one to see. I know they have a show on Broadway right now. It's not doing quite as well. And you know, I will say the clowning in Cirque du Soleil has never been as good as it was with David, when David Shiner was in charge like 30 years ago. He was some of the best clown I've ever seen, as well as acrobatics. The clowning has just never been as good. It's just very sort of French and weird. And
did you see that banana spiel thing they did?
No,
I didn't either, but I heard it was lots of clowning.
And I think he had something to do with that, but again, back in the day, there was a perfect balance of acrobatics, aesthetics, and clowning, and he was part of that original crew. And again, not every component is as I remember it, but boy, it's a good show. Anyway, Curios with a K. I think that's another off script for you all. Links to the things we talked about will be on our show page, is that right?
Yes.
Rate us on iTunes. What else do we say?
I think that's about it. Rate us on iTunes.
All right.
Write us a review. That'd be nice.
Helps people find us.
All right. Till next time.